Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, legislation over so-called sanctuary cities in Florida cleared the first major hurdle this week in the state legislature. Now, the measure aims to ensure that local governments comply with requests from federal immigration authorities.
Yeah, it passed a key Senate panel on Tuesday after lawmakers voted to strip language out of the proposal that would have penalized local officials who declare their communities safe havens for undocumented immigrants. Republican Senator and State Republican Chairman Joe Gruters is the sponsor of the bill.
This is about saving lives, protecting Americans, and making sure that people follow the law. We are a country of laws. This is not a new law. It just says basically let's follow the laws that are on the book and let's comply with the federal government.
Of course, this is at the heart of the raging debate over immigration in America, and there have been contentious debates in other states about sanctuary cities. What do you think of this proposed ban on sanctuary cities in Florida? We're going to begin the Florida Roundup with a closer discussion as we welcome Samantha Gross. She's the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald. She joins us now from WFSU in Tallahassee. Samantha, good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
And already getting your tweets, we want your calls too on sanctuary cities. What do you think of this proposed ban in Florida? Give us a call anywhere in the state on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. That's 305-995-1800, or tweet us at Florida Roundup. And Samantha, let's begin by defining what a sanctuary city is. It's a pretty broad term. Can you explain to listeners who haven't followed this what it means and if there's a city in Florida that's considered to be one?
Yeah, so a sanctuary city is actually more of a colloquial term used to describe a city, a county, basically any entity that has rules in place that would bar those entities from reporting undocumented immigrants to federal immigration authorities or ICE. It's hard to pick out, you know, how many sanctuary jurisdictions, if any, are in Florida, because organizations use different criteria to determine that. So during the bill's hearing, Senator Gruters did call out places like Broward County, Key West, St. Petersburg, to name a few, that he says aren't up to par with honoring ICE detainer requests. But none of that information is directly coming from ICE or state law enforcement. It's citing some 2018 studies that analyze certain places around the state.
Samantha, Broward County, for instance, Broward County would say it is not a sanctuary county. Miami-Dade, of course, the largest county by population in the state, is not doesn't consider itself a sanctuary city. There's no legal definition of this. This bill tries to get to that, but it really gets down to, doesn't it, this idea of requiring local police and state police to have basic ordering agreements in place with federal immigration authorities, ICE, so that there is something in place that requires the cooperation of somebody who's been arrested by a local police officer who then could get bonded out. But if ICE learns of that and immigration authorities provide a detention request, that person would remain in custody.
Correct. Yeah. So basically, if ICE does send those detainer requests, local law enforcement would be required to honor that detainer. And that just means holding those people for up to 48 hours after their set release date, basically just allowing time for immigration agents to come to local law enforcement and take care of that.
And it's 305-995-1800. What do you think of the push in Tallahassee to ban what have been called sanctuary cities? Give us a call. Tweet us, too, at Florida Roundup. Samantha, this isn't the first time we've seen this effort in Florida. It's never really gotten anywhere in the past. Will this legislative session be different? Is there more momentum for this time around?
Yeah, I mean, last time this came up, it did die in the Senate, but because Gruters is the chairman of the party now, he said that his new role as a leader will help boost support for the bill. Our governor, Ron DeSantis, has also made his stance pretty clear on sanctuary cities. When he referenced sanctuary cities in his inaugural address, it drew a big crowd of cheers and claps, and it seems that his stance could possibly, you know, gain more momentum.
And let me ask you as a follow-up, Joe Gruters wasn't able to appear on the Florida Roundup this Friday, but he tweeted the show just a few minutes ago, tweeting at Florida Roundup, remember, it's about public safety and cooperation. This legislation will help keep criminal, illegal aliens off the street. That's the Senate or the state GOP chair and state senator tweeting us. And but let me ask you, though, as a follow up, conservatives oppose the notion of sanctuary cities because they've often cited cases of crimes that have been perpetrated or allegedly perpetrated by undocumented people. ICE has argued that cities that don't cooperate with them inhibit their ability to enforce immigration laws. On the other hand, when you talk about the whole notion of a sanctuary city, this whole movement began, it's my understanding, decades ago in churches, largely in bigger cities in America, as a way to shelter people that were at risk of deportation who had not committed crimes. You know, so major urban centers have really clashed, in particular with the Trump administration over this in the last couple of years. Do you see a possibility of a larger Florida city? Let's say this does make it through the legislative process. Could we see a repeat of that here in Florida, where large metros in this state that tend to be more progressive on these issues clash with the more conservative legislature, a standoff, in other words? We've seen that in other large cities around the country.
Right. I mean, it's hard to say right now, and the bill is still in its early stages. It still has two stops to make through committees where there will be significant changes, likely amendments, things that the senator has said he wants to work on to make the language more palatable for other senators. So it's hard to say, you know, what a future would look like if this bill were to pass off the governor's desk. But this bill, you know, it deals with people who are being detained for other crimes that are not related. And I think that kind of language is going to continue to be worked on through the process. I know President Pro Tempore Simmons has been working with the senator, and I think they're trying to make the language like more palatable for others because it didn't do well in years past.
Samantha, there's also a financial issue here. In Miami-Dade, for instance, in 2013, the county commission took a stance very publicly to say that it was not going to be following or honoring these detention requests, in part because of the financial costs, that these were federal accusations, charges, and they were being the county in this case was being requested to keep these people in custody at the county's expense for a certain number of hours or even days. The county reversed that stance in 2017 under the threat of losing federal funding and federal agency money from the Department of Justice and others after the Trump administration came into play here. Does this bill address any of the financial components of having local and county law enforcement essentially detain these individuals at the request of federal immigration authorities in county or city lockups?
Yeah, it actually does address that a few times within the bill, particularly addressing reimbursement of costs. So the bill would require each county correctional facility to basically enter an agreement with a federal immigration agency for things like housing and the payments of the cost of those people who are the subject of the immigration detainer. So the reimbursement aspect is brought up, I believe, three separate times in the bill.
Great. 305-995-1800 is the phone number, talking about immigration, sanctuary cities, honoring federal immigration detention requests by local law enforcement here in the Sunshine State. We'll begin with your phone call. Central Florida, Orlando, Jim on line four. Go ahead, Jim. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think it's fine to enter into these agreements and legislation. I think there's a misconception that local law enforcement is going to go out and have roundup parties for people that they think are illegal immigrants, and that's not the case. You know, we hold detainers on foreign individuals as well as outside states for, you know, active warrants or detainers. And I don't think there's anything different. There's nothing wrong with enforcing the laws that we have.
Great, Jim. I appreciate that phone call. 305-995-1800, this debate over sanctuary cities. St. Petersburg next up in the Tampa area. Bruce on line three. Go ahead, Bruce. Bruce, are you with us? Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, I wanted to just say that I think that the idea of sanctuary cities is one that needs to be encouraged, not discouraged. And I think if you look at the people who want to encourage this, it's strictly the Republican administration who are anti-immigration, period.
Bruce,
thanks for that. You know,
I'm curious, Samantha, about the relationship between the Trump administration and the new governor, Governor DeSantis, and perhaps what that could spell for the fate of this legislation should it get through the process in the Senate and the House.
I mean, Governor DeSantis, like I mentioned before in his inaugural address, he said a lot of things that sounded similar to things that the president has said, where, you know, he wants Florida to not allow sanctuary cities, to not incentivize illegal immigration, kind of tying those two together. And I mean, it, you know, their close relationship seems like there could be, you know, a lot of sharing of ideas, but it's hard to say still. It's early on what the final bill language will look like.
And here's a tweet coming in from Sharla tweeting the Florida Roundup, and also Joe Gruter's, "You're a liar. This is all about right-wing thugs like you bullying the big cities that don't toe your fascist line." And so, Samantha, the caller, Bruce, saying, you know, he's on the side of the cities. He's on the side of more moderate immigration policies. The urban-rural split on this is no different in Florida than anywhere in the country. And where you stand on these issues of immigration, you know, is so indicative probably where you stand, whether you identify as a Republican or a Democrat. Now, we have a Republican governor, a Republican-dominated legislature, but we also have a number of large cities in Florida. And so, you know, as we look at this feedback coming in on Twitter in particular, what about that? This idea that for people that are urban dwellers, they see these types of measures as bullying people that live in cities and favor a different tack on immigration.
Yeah, I mean, when the bill was heard at first, people drove up to testify from cities all across the state, all the way from Miami to the Tampa, St. Petersburg area to Orlando. And a lot of them were part of, you know, religious groups or part of the Florida Immigrants Coalition. And a lot of their concerns that they expressed were that this could be a form of bullying or targeting. They, you know, some people brought up a point of driving without a license. You know, if you are an undocumented immigrant here and you can't get a driver's license, if you're pulled over, you will be detained on those charges. And because you're detained on separate charges, that could put you at risk for, you know, being reported to ICE. And so there is definitely a split. I mean, there were probably 75 or 80 people that filled the committee room that wanted to speak on this. And the conversation does get contentious between groups. And I think it's conversation that's worth having in front of the panel of senators who are going to ultimately be making this call.
And it's a bill that would, as it moves forward, a bill that would ban sanctuary cities in Florida, essentially just cleared its first hurdle in Tallahassee. Long process, though, before it would become law. And lots of calls coming into the Florida Roundup. It's 305-995-1800 this Friday. Nathaniel is in St. Pete. Hey, Nathaniel, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for having me. One thing I'd like to say real quick is that it'd be nice if we wouldn't let them control the narrative and turning the word sanctuary into pejorative the same way they turn amnesty into pejorative. And maybe we should call them tolerant towns, because we're not going to be giving sanctuary to rapists, murderers, traffickers, drug dealers. But what we are going to do if we get rid of tolerant towns is we're going to create a schism between local law enforcement and the community. And doing that will absolutely make us less safe.
And why do you think there would be a schism created between the community and law enforcement, Nathaniel, in the sense that communities would be reluctant to talk to authorities over this one issue? Share a little bit more of what you're thinking there.
Sure. Well, like victims and witnesses and people like that who need to interact with local law enforcement to get the really bad guys, you know, the good people who need to get the really bad guys, won't want to talk to local law enforcement if they're looking at local law enforcement as someone who is also an ICE agent or also an agent that could have them and their whole family removed just because they are now on their radar and have to do it mandatory, like mandatory sentences, we've learned don't work, because sometimes we should allow a judge to judge the situation and say, okay, I actually need this information from you to go get that rapist, traffic, murderer guy. I don't really care that you're, you know, quote unquote, an illegal. That's fine. Just help me get the people that are doing real harm. And that communication is very, very, you know, gentle. It's a very delicate thing. And if we start stomping on that, the local law enforcement is going to lose a lot of that trust, and that's going to make us less safe.
All right. That's Nathaniel in St. Pete. Thanks for that. Samantha Gross. Terminology, what we call things, particularly in politics, is just fraught with meaning, and sometimes more than one meaning. What about his suggestion of the branding of this, that the term sanctuary has become a loaded term, that instead people defending large cities' immigration stance should rebrand themselves tolerant towns?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the language within the bill has, you know, given issue to some of the people who are against it. The people who came and testify have issues with the language, like sanctuary cities, but also using the word illegal to describe undocumented immigrants is something that people
sure.
have taken up. Yeah, words matter, I guess. And I think, you know, it's hard to, I think that it's, you know, watching your words is something that a lot of people have been, you know, trying to bring up in these committees. And the name of the bill isn't the Sanctuary City Bill. I just want to clarify. It's actually the Federal Immigration Enforcement is the subject of the bill. But Sanctuary Cities has kind of been the colloquial term that people use to describe this. And those words are used within the bill.
And it is, yeah. The short title of the bill is the Rule of Law Adherence Act. So there's a
doesn't even say immigration.
Doesn't quite roll off your tongue necessarily, but yeah, the idea of sanctuary cities is certainly embedded in the language of this proposed legislation. 305-995-1800. Sanctuary cities, tolerant towns, honoring federal immigration detention requests by local police. That essentially is the issue here. On line five, Martha in Miami, a retired law enforcement agent. Martha, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
I have so many comments on this issue. I'll try to keep it short. I actually testified before the Miami-Dade Commission in 2017 when the county reversed. But I have two separate comments. And one is that after 9/11, there were questions about local law enforcement detaining people for questioning versus domestic terrorism and everything else. And the U.S. Constitution guarantees that when you step foot on our soil, you will not be held in a detention facility without an order by a judge or you've committed a crime. So to ask local law enforcement officers and corrections officers to detain people after they've already been released from whatever crime they've been arrested for, driving with license suspended or whatever.
Martha, our time is tight here. I want you to make your second point, but isn't the argument that by entering the country illegally or without proper documents, that in itself is a crime?
No. You can talk to the lawyers and get a lawyer's opinion on that one. The most important is my last part of my career was in sexual crimes. It's tough enough to get a victim of a sexual crime or a child or adult to report a crime. If you think this law is going to make people less, you know, more safe, you know, if immigrants that are here do not trust the police to report a crime, then that subject goes free and may commit a crime against a lawful citizen.
Martha, thank you.
Last point.
Thank you for sharing those points from the front lines there, retired law enforcement in South Florida. Martha, you can join the conversation. Sanctuary cities, immigration at the local level here in Florida is what we're talking about on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. A week ago, the federal government avoided another partial shutdown over immigration. President Donald Trump will use more than $3.5 billion from military construction projects to help pay for part of his southern border wall.
Now, if his President Trump's emergency declaration holds, withstands a legal challenge, some of that money could come out of military spending planned for Florida. Now, as the state legislature debates a bill that would require local police to honor immigration detention requests, we've just been talking about that on the Florida Roundup, getting all of your calls and tweets. At the same time, the president's national emergency declaration over immigration could be felt in military communities here, and quite a few of them around the state. Keep those calls coming to the Florida Roundup as we talk about this at 305-995-1800. Tweets to Florida Roundup as we welcome Howard Altman. He covers military affairs for the Tampa Bay Times and joins the show via FaceTime. Howard, thanks for being with us. And Samantha Gross, state government reporter for the Herald Times Bureau, still on the show with us. Let's begin with you, though, Howard. Let's assume that this goes through and the president is able to obtain funding that's currently allocated for military construction and divert that to the border wall he wants on the southern border. Is this allowed under the executive order? Can he go ahead and do this?
Well, if the president, the executive order in essence holds that if there's a need for the military to be involved in this, then they can pull from this pool of unobligated military construction funds, and I'll let the courts and everybody else figure out what's going to happen with that. But in terms of military construction funding, that's money used to build things on military bases, there's a pool of about $21 billion of funding that's been allocated for military construction projects over the last 5 years, but is yet to be obligated. Nobody has signed a contract to say this is going to happen on X date. No money has been obligated. There's in Florida, there are five projects on that list worth about $177 million. That includes a $3.1 million to relocate a KC-135 Stratotanker pilot flight simulator to MacDill Air Force Base here in Tampa. Those are those gray aerial refueling tankers. Other projects include $83 million for a littoral combat ship support facility and $29 million for a littoral combat ship operational training facility at the Mayport Naval Base in Jacksonville. And then there's two projects at Eglin Air Force Base in Okaloosa County, $35 million for an F-35A training center and $28 million for an F-35A student dormitory there. So those are projects on this list. Other states have even greater number of facilities that could be affected.
Howard, it's Tom Hudson. How does this kind of spending that could be put at risk, military spending, construction spending in Florida at military bases, how does that compare with, say, a normal five-year period or so? Is this an active construction period? Is this about average for the military and the kind of spending that happens in these communities?
I think this is fairly, average. It ebbs and flows depending on, what's going on. As you see, in MacDill, we've had more construction in the past, frankly, so it's on the lower end. We've had, in the last several years, had a new command headquarters for U.S. Central Command. We've had a new headquarters for the Special Operations Command, Joint Special Operations University. So this is a comparatively small number. It kind of ebbs and flows base to base over the years.
And have the brass expressed frustration with this reallocation of funding? What are you hearing from the top military brass?
I mean, the people, the ones who this is most affected are the base commanders and then some of the other folks. They're not really saying anything because they don't like to get out ahead of the Pentagon, let alone Congress. Military leaders are very, very reluctant and almost never talk about what Congress is going to do because there's nothing really they can do about it. They've obviously, when these things got into the pipeline, there was a reason why they got into the pipeline. People wanted to see these things happen. So, but there's nobody that's really going public, stomping their foot and saying, this shouldn't happen. Not on the military side.
Samantha Gross, let me ask you, we're covering state government and the governor for the Herald Times Bureau in Tallahassee. The governor spent time in the service, certainly. He's close to the Trump administration, we know. Has this gotten his attention? Has this $177 million of military construction spending plan for Florida military bases potentially at risk with this emergency declaration over immigration? Has this garnered any attention with the governor and the administration here in Florida?
I mean, to be honest, at all of the governor's events, at, you know, times where he's taking questions, he seems pretty keyed in on things that are going to be affecting the state and things that he wants to work with the president on for funding elsewhere. Questions about this have not really come up on the state level yet, but I'm sure that as these things move forward, the governor will make some sort of comment. I mean, him and the president are quite close, and it's something that he does talk about with some frequency.
And it's at the intersection of, you know, immigration policy, with the president's certainly focused in on, and the military, which we know the governor is interested in, and, of course, economic development and economic stimulus with a lot of these military communities that could be at risk here. So I got to imagine it's going to attract some attention if, in fact, Howard, if this threat is real. I mean, are these dollars just sitting in the Treasury account waiting to be spent, waiting to be allocated?
They're waiting to be allocated. They have not been spent. Okay. Now, obviously, these are, you know, of big concern to local communities and to the bases themselves, because they are an economic impact. And there's, you know, for instance, let's talk about the KC-135 trainer. The more that pilots and crews can train on a simulator, the better that they're going to perform out in the field. So it's a real readiness issue for the military, you know, particularly as the cost of actually flying these aircraft is expensive, and the Air Force wants to see more emphasis on simulator training. So there's a, you know, readiness. There's real military reasons why these things are in the pipeline.
Definitely. Anyone that's covered military affairs knows, I would think, too, that nothing moves at lightning speed except high-performance aircraft. So I guess things are sort of standing pat for a little bit in Florida while this whole emergency order, which is controversial, is being sorted out in the courts. We're in a watch-and-wait mode, I guess.
It's standing pat all over. The acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan and DOD officials are on the Hill today meeting with folks and trying to, you know, let them know what's going on. I talked to the Pentagon this morning, and they said that there's no official timeline yet, no decision yet on which bases will be affected. So everybody's kind of watching and waiting and going to see what happens. Probably in the next several days, we'll have a better idea of which bases will be affected. Don't forget, there's a lot of facilities overseas, which I think is one of the areas that they're going to look at. Again, it's a political issue, because if you cut from a local community, you can have some upset, Congress people and upset voters. So that's something that, when you look at the political algorithms, will be taken into account, no doubt.
Sure. Important for Florida economically, militarily.
Huge.
Politically, we'll have to continue following it. And Howard Altman, we need to shift gears now. So thank you so much for being with us. Howard Altman, who covers military affairs for the Tampa Bay Times. Also, thanks to Samantha Gross, covering state government for the Herald Times Bureau in Tallahassee. Thanks to you both. And you are listening to the Florida Roundup, coming to you from Florida Public Radio.
Border security now. How about securing American interests in space? President Donald Trump wants to create a new branch of the military that would handle threats in space. It has been called Space Force. Vice President Mike Pence made the announcement back in December at the Kennedy Space Center. Pence saying that China and Russia are working on ways to hack and disrupt U.S. satellites, and these new challenges demand new responses.
A new era of American national security in space begins today.
And just this week, Governor Ron DeSantis, by tweet, asked the president to place the Space Force headquarters here in Florida.
We formally asked the president to locate the new combatant command for space in the state of Florida. I think it'd be a natural place to do. We have places like Cape Canaveral where it would work very, very well.
WMFE's space reporter Brendan Byrne is on the show now to talk about this new military branch, joining us from their studios in Orlando. And with me at WJCT in Jacksonville, Todd Lindner. He runs the Cecil Spaceport. They're developing commercial space travel on the west side of Jacksonville. Gentlemen, good to have you both on the show. And give us a call from anywhere in the state as we talk about space in Florida, space travel, space tourism, the space industry. We want your calls here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800 and tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Brendan Byrne at WMFE in Orlando. Let's begin with you. How would this Space Force that the president wants to bring about, how would it work?
So the Space Force, as you mentioned in the intro there, the ball got rolling this week when the president signed Space Policy Directive 4. And in the policy's words, it would, quote, marshal space resources to deter and counter threats in space. So it's kind of this broad overview of or this broad outline of how we can use these military forces to kind of protect our assets in space and protect us down here on the ground. So this is kind of laying the groundwork for it. The idea of a space force has kind of evolved since the president first mentioned it. When the idea first came up, this was to be a separate branch of the military. And through Space Policy Directive 4 and moving forward, it kind of lays out this outline as this is going to be a part of the Air Force now. So the Air Force will take over control of the military space assets.
And in addition to military action in space, let's talk about just the reshaping of the space industry, both in Central Florida and up here in North Florida. Todd Lindner, tell us about plans, which we've been hearing about for several years now, for a commercial spaceport in Jacksonville, which would be unique on the Eastern Seaboard, is my understanding, correct?
Yeah, thank you for having me today, Melissa. We obtained a horizontal launch license to conduct horizontal launch operations of reusable launch vehicles in 2010. Since then, we've been working toward putting in place the infrastructure necessary to accommodate the commercial space industry. You have to be careful how you use the term launch. When we say launch, people often think and assume we're talking about vertical launch activity similar to what you see down at the Cape.
A rocket, yeah.
A rocket. And it's quite different than that. What we do here in Jacksonville is horizontal launch activities. The vehicle takes off, looks very similar to a aircraft that you see out there flying around today, and it will either have a space vehicle that's attached to it or a payload that will be ejected, and it will go into orbit.
And what's the timeline for actual flights to potentially be going off from CSOL?
We currently have three launches that are scheduled. One that will go that's planned before the end of this year, and two at the beginning of 2020.
That's solid. That's set. That's the first time I've heard you or anyone at CSOL Spaceport say, "Okay, we're go for launch." Although I have to use that term in a as you said, in a careful way.
Yes.
So I think we're breaking some news here on the Florida Roundup.
Well, that's the schedule and that's the plan. And the only thing that's consistent about a plan is it always changes.
Oh well, there you go, Tom. Things could change,
yeah.
But it's exciting to hear about this. This private space industry, Brendan, you weigh in too, develops in Florida in an increasingly robust way.
Yeah, even just this morning, Governor Ron DeSantis was here at Cape Canaveral announcing another private space company that's going to call Florida home, and it's a Firefly space company. They develop and launch vertical small rockets to send small payloads into space. So it seems there's consistent growth in the private space industry as early as recently as this morning.
So Brendan, this is Tom. Where does the Space Force fit into this? I mean, we saw, you know, the Space Coast have to reinvent itself here in Florida after the shuttle program ended. And now we're seeing, you know, not a month go by without private industry certainly launching from Cape Canaveral. Where does this new national government effort in terms of military and space fit into this?
It's unclear at the moment, but I've talked to some analysts, and it's actually pretty interesting because one of the analysts I talked to said, you know, the Governor DeSantis's call to have the Central Command of the Space Force headquartered here in Florida is kind of like this perfect storm of things that have happened over the past 8 years, right? So you've got the end of the space shuttle program and the end of this major civilian project in Brevard County. You've got 8 years of Governor Rick Scott with this kind of push for privatization of of the space industry and bringing some of these big names to the Space Coast, like SpaceX and Blue Origin. And then you have Governor Ron DeSantis getting elected and having this relationship with the president. So it's kind of like this perfect storm where this call to have it headquartered here would be great for the state, but also the resources are already here. There's all these private companies that could be these, you know, defense contractors for a Space Force are already in place and attracting other suppliers to come to this area. So it's pretty interesting to see this perfect storm of 8 years of kind of ebbs and flows of, and the evolution of Florida's Space Coast.
Well, it certainly the space age made the Space Coast in Florida. Gordon in Kissimmee on line four, phone number 305-995-1800. Gordon, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking my call, guys. My question for the panel is their opinion. From what I understand, the Air Force already has a department working on satellite safety and basically space safety. So I'm wondering, you know, is a Space Force really necessary if a branch is already working on this?
Brendan, how about it? As you mentioned earlier, this was originally kind of designed to be a new branch of the military, but the Air Force apparently lobbied successfully with the Trump administration to insert itself here. What about Gordon's position that the Air Force is already up there working on these kinds of things?
Yeah, that was the criticism from the start, and also some other criticism is that this would just add another level of bureaucracy to military space efforts. I think that The Space Force is looking to kind of streamline these things. So a lot of branches of the military do have kind of these resources in space. So certain branches of the government will have communication satellites or GPS or whatnot in space. And the idea of Space Force is to kind of consolidate them and put them all in one lane in order to better manage these resources as a defense. And as the caller mentioned, the Air Force does take care of a lot of this. The 45th Space Wing right here, you know, they basically handle launches and weather forecasting here at the Cape, and there's a similar one on the West Coast. That's been a common criticism that you hear when it comes to Space Force.
Lots of folks waiting on hold to weigh in here on the Florida Roundup. Add your voice to the conversation as we talk about the Space Force commercial space flight in Florida and your calls and tweets. It's 305-995-1800 as we talk space. A quick break and your calls right after this here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
And that was the sound of the most recent space launch from Florida. Yeah, it was a SpaceX rocket that blasted off last night from Cape Canaveral. On board is an Israeli unmanned robotic lander headed for the moon.
And it still gets the hair on the back of my neck to stand up.
It's exciting.
Hear
yeah.
that sound, no doubt about it. Another space launch is actually scheduled just a week from Sunday from the Space Coast. That one is a joint mission with SpaceX and NASA. The Space Coast is a busy place these days, and Governor Ron DeSantis wants to keep it that way.
I think space is going to continue to be an important part of Florida's economy.
As we continue talking space here on the Florida Roundup with your calls and tweets, let's also get some more wisdom from WMFE's space reporter Brendan Byrne and Todd Lindner, who runs the Cecil Spaceport on the west side of Jacksonville, planning commercial launches, or flights, I should say, later this year and possibly next. In a moment, we'll hear about the growth at Cecil. But first, Brendan Byrne, let me ask you, as we talk about private space industry here in Florida, tell us a little bit more about what you saw at the Cape when Governor DeSantis dropped by.
So Governor DeSantis announced what we've kind of been hearing about for a few months now, but it was made official today. Firefly Space is going to be taking up residence at Cape Canaveral. And Firefly Space is an interesting company. They have a small rocket that takes small payloads into space. And it's about $15 million a launch, which sounds like a lot to you and me, but in the grand scheme of things, it's a really inexpensive way to get stuff into space. And with the announcement today, Firefly has agreed to build a $52 million facility and bring some 200,000 jobs to the Space Coast that are over $70,000 a year. So this is a big get for some high-paying jobs at the Space Coast. And it kind of follows suit, and a lot of other companies have been doing the same thing over the past few years. You've seen Blue Origin make a similar announcement, another company called OneWeb Satellites, with these high-paying jobs that are coming to the Space Coast. So it's just another in a long line of private companies calling Space Coast home.
And the Space Coast is obviously the center of so much activity, but Todd Lindner with Cecil Spaceport, used to be known as Cecil Field and Airport, then it became known as Cecil Commerce Center, and now as plans are developing for it to become a spaceport, how big a sector is this emerging as? Tell us a little bit more about how you see the growth of this industry here in Florida, not just in Central Florida, but in other parts of the state and also up and down the Eastern Seaboard.
Well, from my perspective, the industry is growing leaps and bounds, as was already mentioned. Right now, we're looking at approaching one launch a week, and currently, the folks at the 45th Space Command, as mentioned earlier, is providing a lot of the services for these operations. Going forward, I think the 45th Space Wing will end up probably get to a point where they're spread pretty thin, and they will be probably doing a lot of work with
So a good problem to have as this industry grows. What are some other challenges that you're facing? Because it's been a several years of hearing hints of Cecil Spaceport being operational, but not yet. So this is a heavy lift, no doubt.
Well, from that standpoint, Cecil Spaceport has been operational since the day we obtained our license. In the meantime, though, we've been putting in new infrastructure because we would like to provide 21st century infrastructure to replace a lot of the infrastructure that was placed out there for World War II and in the Vietnam era.
Yeah, transitioning from the World War II era to the space era. Yeah, that's
exactly right.
A big challenge. And so it's 305-995-1800 as we talk space on the show. Let's go to Ozzy in Titusville. Ozzy, did you watch the launch?
Oh, did I ever. I was in Space View Park in Titusville with about 250, 300 of my best new friends. They all came over from the Orlando attractions area. When they arrived for their vacations, they had no clue there was a launch on, and once they found out, they found their way for a viewing site, and Space View Park in Titusville is one of the best.
You know, Brendan, it's amazing to watch a space shot. I think, as Tom said a minute ago, that never is a boring thing, no matter how many of them you've seen.
Not at all, and I have to give a shout-out to Ozzy. I met Ozzy on my first assignment as space reporter here when EFT exploration flight mission took off. I believe it was 2014, and I got to hang out with Ozzy and all of his friends watching the launch, and it is definitely a spectacle, and it never gets old. I think I've covered dozens since then, and they're all exciting every single time.
They're all exciting, but they can become commonplace. I mean, that was certainly a criticism with the shuttle program. There was complacency with the program itself, complacency with the public attitude toward it and the public interest in it, as well as obviously the hundreds of millions of tax dollars that it took, billions of dollars that it took to continue that program. As you're seeing, Todd and Brendan, as you're seeing both NASA reinvigorate, you're seeing conversations about a space force within the Air Force and what that may mean for the Space Coast. And then, of course, this commercial interest, the for-profit interest, are we already in or perhaps entering into what may be another golden age of space travel and space investment in the state of Florida, but building capacity perhaps that the market is not going to be able to sustain over the next several decades, given the kinds of runways, pun intended, that are necessary for these kinds of investments to pay off. Todd, how about it from your perspective?
I don't think there'll ever be another golden age like we experienced in the 60s. That was remarkable. It may be close. However, I just don't see it being that that great. Hope it is, but you know, hope for the best. I think the biggest challenge that we're going to incur as we go forward with the significant increase in the number of launches is the one piece of infrastructure and resource that we always fail to consider, and that is airspace. The airspace congestion and the modifications have to be made with the air carriers and the other folks that are wanting to use the airspace. I think that's going to be the primary challenge, and that's going to be something that's going to be dealt
and
with initially.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, coming to you across the state from Florida Public Radio. Here's a tweet from Tyler. He tweets the show, "I reckon my biggest disappointment as a formerly homeless veteran is that this administration refuses to address current issues within the military community. Instead, we get Space Force." You know, we've been talking both about the Space Force proposal from the administration and commercial space travel in the state with Brendan Byrne of WMFE and Todd Linder of Cecil Spaceport. Now, Todd, I just want to nail you down really quickly. You said that you have launch dates set. Can you give us a little bit more detail about your calendar and what these flights will look like and who will be on them, and will the public be able to access them? All the details.
No.
You know, I got to ask.
Actually, I can give you a little information about one in particular. Our initial launch customer is a company called Generation Orbit, who is out of Atlanta. They have a launch that's scheduled. It was originally scheduled for the end of December. That date has been moved to January. They're working with a governmental customer that I can't talk a whole lot about. However,
so in January 2020, you're going to take off from Cecil Spaceport with a government client. So the average people with a lot of money to spend, they're not going to be able to hitch a ride to space in the early going. Is that fair to say?
No, they could.
They could. Okay. How much would they have to pay?
That's up to the launch operator. As a spaceport.
Oh, come on now. You can give me a ballpark figure. Is Lance Bass going to come to Jacksonville and hop a ride to space? That's all I want to know right now.
He may already have. anyone can. However, those arrangements are through the launch operator.
Okay, gotcha.
Brendan,
all right.
Brendan, talk about kind of this intersection between government contractors or government contracting for the space travel and the market potential of space tourism, and frankly, what the infrastructure is about, how the Space Coast is set up, and what they're trying to work, what Todd's working on up in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I think the one thing that we can highlight is the launch that is happening very soon. I think it's March 2nd. Is a contract between SpaceX and NASA, and this is a partnership called Commercial Crew, which NASA has relied solely on the Russians to get astronauts to the space station. They've partnered with SpaceX and another private company, Boeing, to do it and do it at a much cheaper price. So there's one of those partnerships there that we're starting to see. And there's also, I think, the fact that there are places in Jacksonville that are expanding the space launch capabilities goes to show you that there is a market out there for this. The Brevard County and the Space Coast is running out of launch pads, and there's places coming online, like in Jacksonville. There's another one in right off the coast of Georgia, and that goes to show you that there is a market for launching.
Todd Linder.
Yes, that's very true. There's, you know, one of the things that we've always said here in Jacksonville is we always want to be, we would never be Cape Kennedy, Cape Canaveral. We always wanted to serve in the capacity of being a complement to them. Anything we could do to assist and help them to fulfill their mission, we would do so. And as time goes on, we see a lot of the overflow from the needs and demands at the Cape actually coming our direction.
Todd, thanks.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about this, isn't it, Tom?
Absolutely.
It's great stuff.
The countdown is on. We'll be watching here. The space age helped to certainly slingshot the Florida economy in the 50s and 60s, no doubt about it. Todd Linder runs the Cecil Spaceport on the west side of Jacksonville. Brendan Byrne with us from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE, where he has a line of sight to Cape Canaveral and several launch pads there as he watches all things space for us. Brendan, Todd, thanks so much for your time.
Always a pleasure.
To infinity and beyond, guys. That's our show, The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Bridget O'Brien and Heather Schatz are producers.
And this is Bridget's last program with us. She's been an invaluable member of our team here at WLRN and Florida Public Radio and The Roundup. Thank you very much, Bridget, for all the work that you've done. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
Of Cultural Affairs.